Good evening, everybody. I said good evening, everybody. It's polite to say good evening.
Good evening, Dr. Krishnan.
Yeah, exactly. Good evening, Dr. Krishnan. Yes, hello, everybody. Welcome and thank you for coming on this lovely Saturday evening. My name is Madhu Krishnan. I'm a lecturer in English at the University of Bristol, and I am delighted to be here with Nikesh Shukla, who I feel needs no introduction, but he will have one quite soon, for a brief reading and a conversation. I wanted to start by saying that this is actually the final event in a day-long workshop that we've been having at the university that's been titled Ethics, Affect, and Responsibility, Global Citizenship, and the Act of Reading. And this is part of a year-long series of events that I've been organizing in conjunction with the British Academy that's trying to examine the idea of literature as a tool for social justice. We hear a lot of truisms about how reading makes you a better person, how reading makes you more empathic, how reading makes you a global citizen, how reading makes you less prejudiced. But qualitative studies actually suggest a quite different picture, in which reading can sometimes do something that's completely at odds with these sorts of truisms, in which reading can make you very appropriative, reading can make you reinforce hierarchies, reading can make you think you understand in ways that actually are quite oppressive. This morning we discovered that social scientific empirical research says reading does in fact make you more empathic, but the kind of open question is, what happens with that empathy? What do we do? And so for that reason, I'm very excited to be here with Nikesh, who has been a very active voice, I think, in British popular culture and the literary scene, thinking about issues of representation and race and actually the kind of world that literature creates that we all believe somehow to be true. Nikesh Shukla, as you all no doubt already know, is the author of two novels, Coconut Unlimited, which was shortlisted for the Costa First Novel Award in 2010 and longlisted for the Desmond Elliott Prize in 2011. And Meat Space, his second novel. And I actually think that's like the funniest title for a book I've ever heard. I just like talking about it a lot to people because I like to say Meat Space a lot. In 2011, he co-wrote with Kieran Yates the essay Generation Vexed, What the Riots Don't Tell Us About Our Nation's Youth. His short stories have been featured in numerous anthologies and magazines, and he's been a writer in residence for BBC Asian Network and Royal Festival Hall. He's based here in Bristol, luckily for us, and he manages the youth magazine Rife, which I think a lot of us will be familiar with. He's on Twitter, and I definitely would urge everyone, if you do one thing after today, is follow him on Twitter, because he's like a prolific tweeter.
If you did two things, could you buy my books as well?
I was getting there. So actually, if you do one thing, buy the book. If you do another thing, follow him on Twitter. And Nikesh is the editor of The Good Immigrant, which, I mean, I think you must have started it post-Brexit, but it feels particularly timely now. And The Good Immigrant is a project that brings together 20 emerging British, Black, Asian, minority ethnicity writers, poets, journalists, and artists to confront the issue of what is it to be a good immigrant? What is it to be an immigrant in British today? What is it to be a person who is a brown face in a white space? And we'll be talking a bit about that today and a few other things. And as Nick, do you want to do that again? Do you want to like Vanna White that a little? We are very, very, very fortunate tonight because the book has not actually come out. And you might be thinking, how could it not come out when it's right there? Well, that's through the magic of connections. We do have a limited amount of copies on sale today prior to the publication date. I think you might be amenable to signing them maybe for people or something of that sort. And so I'm very pleased to welcome Nikesh Shukla tonight to be talking to us here at Watershed.
Hi.
So just to give you an idea of what we're going to do, Nikesh is going to give us a bit of a reading. We're going to have a bit of a chat. He's going to read something else, and then it's your chance to grill him. When we have the questions, there will be a roving mic. I'll remind you again, but this event is being recorded because we're going to try to podcast it on the project website. So please, when you're asking questions at the end of the event, wait till you have the roving mic. But I'm just going to shut up now because we want to hear from you.
That was an awkward silence. I did it on purpose. Okay, I'm going to read from the book The Good Immigrant, but I'm going to go over there because sitting at a table reading just feels weird. So, exactly. Seamless, right? Okay, so This is an essay collection called The Good Immigrant that's coming out next week. I don't know if any of you have heard of it. Amazing if you have. So last year I read two books. One was Citizen by Claudia Rankine, and one was Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. And they were both amazing non-fiction, long-form memoir essays about what it means to be black in America today and what it means to have a black body in America. And I was so blown away by these books. And I started trying to find a UK equivalent, and it made me realise how few opportunities there were for writers of colour in the UK to write in their own voices and write in a space that wasn't fetishised or romanticised. And I was talking about this with my friend Musrock Wonga, who's a broadcaster and journalist on Twitter, and he was telling me about this, you know, this theory about the good immigrant, where you kind of, you start off as the bad immigrant because you're here to steal the jobs and the women and the places in the GP waiting room, and then you might win a baking competition, or you might win gold at an Olympic, or you might be a reality TV star, and then you become a good immigrant. And I was saying, I said to him, I would definitely read a collection of essays about race and immigration in the UK called The Good Immigrant. It's a shame it will never happen. And he said, well, he reminded me of the Chinua Achebe quote, if you don't like the story, write your own. And so I was like, well, why don't I do it? Why don't I put together an essay collection? I know a lot of sick writers. So I spoke to a publisher called Unbound, because so much is made out of the lack of diversity in books and the lack of diversity in UK publishing, and you know, we don't have that many writers of colour, but we also don't have that many readers, and because there aren't the writers and there aren't the readers, the books don't get made. And you kind of realise after a while that being brown is a marketing trend, and it's also not a very lucrative marketing trend. And I just think that's not right, because there are lots and lots of readers from BAME backgrounds who want to read and don't necessarily feel catered for. And the publishing industry just doesn't know how to reach them. And I wanted to prove a point that these readers existed. So I went to Unbound, and Unbound basically funds the initial run of its books through crowdfunding. And I said to them, this is what I wanted to do. These are the writers. They've all got really big social media profiles. They're all like people doing lots of interesting things. They're all people that people want to read more from, and a couple of like more exciting unpublished people as well. And they were like, yeah, cool. So I wanted to make the point that these readers exist who want to read authentic, whatever authentic means, what authentic writers of work by writers of colour. And I wanted them to put their money where their mouth was before the book was even out, because I thought that was quite an interesting statement to the publishing industry. And we were 60% funded. No, wait, hold on. We were a third funded after 24 hours. After 2 hours, we were two-thirds funded, because we had the endorsement and patronage from a certain writer called J.K. Rowling. And then by the end of 3 days, we were completely funded. As of today, we're 188% funded, and that's like 1,500 people who wanted to read this book before it's even out. Those are my glasses. And I feel like I made the point. And then just when we thought when we were asking ourselves, like Kanye West did, and the song Power, can we get much higher? No one is a Kanye West fan. So high, yeah. So high. No, anyway. Stop it, Nikesh. On Thursday, I was on BBC Breakfast talking about the book, and Riz Ahmed, who's one of the writers in the book, he's also an actor. He's in the new Jason Bourne film. He's also in a new Star Wars, and he's in an HBO series you might have been watching called The Night Of. And he's a rapper called Riz MC, and an old school friend of mine. He had written an essay for us about being typecast as a terrorist in all of the films that, like, all the auditions he went up for, but also being typecast as a terrorist every time he traveled to America, because every time he traveled to America for work, he would end up being questioned for hours and hours and hours. And, you know, this all started because he was in The Road to Guantanamo, like a docudrama that Michael Winterbottom made about the Tipton Three. And when he came back from that film winning the Venice, the Golden Bear or the Silver Bear at the Venice Film Festival, there was an incident with MI5 which involved someone nearly breaking his wrist and asking if he was going to be making any more films to promote the Islamic cause. And so he wrote this essay, and it went in The Guardian, and it went viral within an hour. And, like, by the end of the day, we were, like, number 9 in the overall Amazon charts just from people reading this essay. That's how powerful the essay was. And so I'm constantly reminded why this book is really, really important. And I haven't got to the bloody reading yet, sorry. I know I'm supposed to read stuff, but it kind of needed caveats for this book. So 20 minutes after the referendum result happened, I was on Twitter, as is my wont. I spend a lot of my time on Twitter. Someone threatened to send my greasy ass on fire, and my timeline was filled with tweets from people telling me it was time to go home. And I almost said to the publisher, we might need to rewrite this book in light of what's happening with Brexit. But my publisher said, quite wisely, this book is much timelier than Brexit, because what's happening with the rise in hate crimes after Brexit, it's nothing new. And actually, what you're writing about in the book, you know, like, it's almost like the statistical rise in hate crimes proved to white people that racism exists, which is a thing that we already knew, having gone through it for decades and decades. So we left the book as it was. Anyway, that's a lot of caveats. The book is out on Thursday. It's very, very exciting. I commissioned 20 essays, and then when I saw how good the 20 essays were, I was like, I better write one. I need to have something in this. And I wrote an essay that's very particular to Bristol, because it kind of unpicks some of the sort of faux spiritualism and hippieisms that happen in Bristol that make it quite hard for a brown person to just exist. And drink chai tea. That was a joke. Anyway, it's called Namaste. And I'm going to read you the essay now. Namaste means hello. Namaste means I'm bowing to you. It's a customary greeting. It's a respectful salutation. It has become a bastardized metaphor for spiritualism. It's white people doing yoga, throwing up prayer hands, chanting Om and saying Namaste like their third eyes are being opened and they can peer directly into the nucleus of spirituality. You need to know this. Because of your skin tone, people will ask you where you're from. If you tell them Bristol, they'll ask you, no, where are your parents from? When they know you're half Indian, one person will try and impress their knowledge of your culture onto you. I can't sleep. It's 2 a.m. and a party is raging across the road. The flat is rented out to students on a regular basis. Your mother is sensibly sleeping with earplugs in. I can hear you purring in the next room. I know that in 4 hours' time, I have to drive you to London to take you to see your dada and your foy and your fua. Spend time with the Indian part of your family. To say namaste to your Indian cousins, aunties and uncles. I'm driving, so I need the sleep. It transpires that the reason the party is so loud is because someone on the top floor of the house is leaning out of his window, smoking and bellowing a conversation down to a person at street level, which, due to the peculiarities of the houses we live opposite, is about 4 stories worth of shouting at 2 a.m. This is silly, I think. It's Friday night, sure, but it's a residential street. I may have been these kids once, but now I'm in my 30s. I'm a man of family now. I'm a man of red wine and Netflix. I'm a man of nights in and community cohesion. I get it. I get what life's about. It's about living like your actions affect the people you don't know as well as the people you do. I've done questionable shit. I've pissed in places I shouldn't have. Left detritus for poor working souls to have to clean up the morning after. Shout, screamed songs at the top of my voice, running down streets where families lived. Been oblivious to the rest of the world, carrying on like there's something out there in the rest of the world for me to interact with. Your mother reminds me of this the next morning when I tell her what happens next. I tell her I don't want to live with the thought that I'm intolerant of other people's intolerance. I walk out of the house just as the conversation bellowed across four stories wraps up and the man on the street level leaves to the sound of his friend hoping he gets home safely. I approach the steps up to their stoop. I notice in the shadows a boy and a girl are sitting in the doorway of the main door, ajar, smoking. "Excuse me," I ask, "do you mind continuing your party inside?" "Jah bless," the girl in the doorway says. "Namaste," she repeats over me. I say it again. I change the words to become clearer, more forceful. "Can you please continue your party inside?" "Namaste," she says again. I hear the boy stifle a laugh. "Namaste," they both say. "Namaste, namaste, 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 namaste," until I'm drowned out. I'm standing under a street lamp wearing my white bedtime kurta and lenga pajamas. My skin is bleached out by the fluorescence of the yellow lamp. There's probably no way they can tell I'm Indian from the lighting. It's dickery for dickery's sake. The bellowing man leaning out of his window asks if the music's too loud. I look up to him, the voice of reason, and I say again, "Can you please continue your party inside?" "Namaste, namaste, namaste," the girl says. I shout something wounded along the lines of, "This is classy, passive-aggressive, without a target." I go back inside and I lie in bed staring at the ceiling, watching the arrows of passing car headlights pierce cracks in the curtains. Eventually the party quietens. My mind doesn't. I'm rolling in a quagmire of ways to deal with this slight. Beyond writing "Namaste dickheads" on a placard and placing it in my bedroom window, I don't know what to do. The house residents go home for the summer, having moved in and warmed the house to celebrate. Any call for apology I ask for come the autumn will be muted and months too late. I walk past an art space that's part bar, club, part sustainable restaurant, part hot desking for freelance artists and part dance studio. They host morning raves and yoga classes there. Most mornings the steps are daubed with hippies wearing Om and Ganesha parachute pants. Their hair in dreadlocks, bindis mark out the third eyes in the middle of their foreheads. They tie their dogs up to the cycle racks using scratchy sari material, and they enter the yoga studio to be Nataraj and Ashtanga geniuses and salute the sun and greet and say goodbye to each other with a solid, heartfelt "Namaste." "Namaste," one of them says to me one morning as I walk down the road listening to Jay Paul swinging my two-tier tiffin up and down. She offers me prayer hands as I pass, and I see her mouthing something. I take my headphones off. Jay Paul's "Straight Out of Mumbai" is at its crescendo. "Namaste," she says. I grimace. "Hi," I reply. "Namaste," she replies, and raises her prayer hands to touch her bowing forehead. She has faded henna on her fingers. "It just means hello," I say. She looks at me confused. "Namaste, it just means hello, that's it." "Namaste," she says again, and I walk on. I have three voices. I realise this when Nirm and his wife come to visit. You're inside your mother's stomach. Your involvement in this story comes just after your mother tells Nirm and his wife that she's pregnant, we're expecting. In his excitement, the typically expressive Nirm gestures wildly with his hands and knocks his pint of beer all over your mum's stomach, all over you. It's funny, but it's not. The way Nirm and I interact is an intersection of our Gujarati upbringing, our East London socialisation, and acknowledgement that there's a white person in the room who needs to keep up. "Yes, bruv, we're talking like Goros be listening, innit? Fata fat, we wipe away pint spill mite while Katie gets fresh again. We call each other bevakoofs, cuss out each other's pronunciation, bruv. We greet with the chemtron mite. We're cursive, glottal-stopping, syllable-swapping, rhythmic beats of anarchic remixed English. Talking to him for the 3 hours he and his wife are in town, I feel like I'm with my peoples again. When I go home, it takes me a while to get my voice back. It's an effort to type this way. In a way that's palatable to Westerners, in a way that's markedly different from my speaking voice, because my speaking voice holds rhythms that weren't made in the West. My mum had three voices. She had her white people phone voice, her Gujlish talk at home voice, and her relatives' voice. I have three voices too. I talk in Gujlish, my normal voice, and white literary party. I don't know whether my normal voice, where I feel most comfortable, most safe, even feels like me anymore. I've splintered into personas. This is the trick of living publicly online with increasing watch and scrutiny by others. When I first started out on Twitter, I had 10 odd followers, all people I knew in the real world, people I could be myself with. As my following increased, I had to become less of myself and more of the public perception of me as the writer. And it made me lose track of who I was and what voice I spoke in. Nowadays, I ensure that whenever I tweet about literary things, I add the odd fam, bruv, cuz, or innit, just to ensure the execution of my thought or praise comes with the necessary rooting to where I'm from. I'm a hip-hop fan, and much as I agree that it's not where you're from, it's where you're at, actually, it's where you're from. An agent who has rejected me twice tweets about an impending apocalypse because his intern referred to clothes as garms. This sends me into a shame spiral. I've been using this word in two of my three voices since 1994. I reply to his tweet saying, slang's more important than proper English, fam. No one talks in proper English, innit? He doesn't reply. I delete my tweet. I know he's still smarting from when I pulled him up on a snarky tweet about diversity in publishing and his ennui towards it. His response was to say that there was a debate of merit worth having. I told him that it wasn't a debate for me, it was my life. I can't change my skin tone. White people debate it, we live it. My conversation with Nerm makes me feel lonely. I watch you in your mum's belly, squirming about, experimenting with spatial awareness, waking up as she and I settle down to bed after the pub. I wonder what voice you'll have, who you'll be, what you'll sound like, and whether you'll have Gujarati reference points or if the extent of your lingual heritage will only be namaste. I knock on my neighbour's door. I know someone's at home because a window at the top of the house is cracked open. I can just about make out the keep calm and carry on poster. I wait, think about my opening line. I don't know whether to be angry or polite and firm or treat it like it's a joke. Like, we're all friends here. Like, I know you guys were just dicking around and that's okay, but just know that words have impact. Or whether to tell him how I feel. One of the many online arguments I've had about the importance of language, how language can hurt, has been about tea. Chai means tea. Chai tea means tea tea. The number of times you see this on the menu makes you wonder why people can't be bothered to do their research. Like, naan bread too. Bread. A comedian, Kumail Nanjiani, an avid gamer, once expressed his delight that the Call of Duty series finally set a level in Karachi, the city of his childhood, now one of the top 10 most dangerous cities in the world. He was appalled on playing the game to see that all the street signs were in Arabic, not in Urdu. He talks about the effort put into making each follicle on each soldier's head stand out, into making their boot laces bounce as they ran. The millions spent developing this game and how at no point did anyone decide to Google the language of Pakistan. In Jurassic Park, they refer to some Pachycephalosaurus dinosaurs as Pachys, or Pachys. The Pachys are escaping, one of the techs exclaims. The budget for the movie was $150 million. If I had to place a value on how much people would have to pay me in order to call me a Pachy, it would be more than $150 million. Because words matter, words are important. The casualness with which someone I'm working with refers to two coloured girls. The casualness with which a person having her photo taken with a nice view and me obscuring the corner of it asks her husband to ensure he gets one without the Indian in it. The casualness of being on the last train home from London to Bristol in the same car as the bar, listening to two drunk men in their early 20s shout at each other, N-word, we made it, repeatedly, with excruciating enthusiasm. They're just quoting rap, someone might think. They're drunk, they're harmless, they're exuberant. Dickish, but exuberant. But language is important. Years ago, I sat in an Indian restaurant around the corner. It's called Oh, Calcutta. I found both exclamation marks alarming. The place was owned by a white guy then. As I sat with my best friend and his then girlfriend staring at the disco lights, I listened to Kulashekar sing about Tattva, about Govinda Jaya Jaya, Gopala Jaya Jaya. I read the menu. One of the dishes listed was chicken chuddy, described as an exotic blend of authentic spices, tomato and pepper. It sounded so generic. What was an exotic blend? What were authentic spices? Also tomato and pepper. These were the biggest tastemakers aside from chicken in the dish. What was chicken chuddy? Also, chuddy means pants. I told my friend and his then girlfriend. They laughed at the whiteness of it all. Ha 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 ha, they said. Cultural misappropriation is hilarious, they said in so many words. I felt mortified for the white guy owner. He'd probably been duped by some guy he'd asked for a word that sounded Eastern. Maybe the chef was having a laugh with him. Maybe he was having a joke with his clients. I looked around. Everyone in the restaurant was white. It was a hipster student paradise, the mix of Cod East and Britpop, minimal red lighting like a moody Ryan Gosling film, and the prices. It felt like puppetry of food, the biggest crime. Not only was the Western Balti now synonymous with my country's cuisine, but now we had white guys aping the food we made to fit in with the white guys. I called the manager over. "The chicken chuddy," I said. "You know chuddy means pants, don't you?" He laughed. "You're having me on, right?" he replied. "It's a specific blend of spices. Nice try." "It means pants," I repeated. He smiled, itching to get away, and I let him. Language is important. The door opens. He stands in front of me. A boy not yet 20 wearing a t-shirt that says "Geeks" on it in the all caps of shouting pride. He holds a controller for a games console in one hand and a cider in the other. "Hello," he says politely, nervously. "Namaste," I say, pressing my hands together in a prayer. "Hello." A car a street away pumps out a banger loop. The subwoofer bounces around my eardrum. I shake my head, turn around and head back across the street. Usually when I leave for work, you're in the window, waving, propped up by your mum. Your smile is free. It doesn't know nuance yet. We should keep it that way. Thanks.